Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hi, welcome to the Josh Marshall Podcast. I'm David Tainter in for Josh today. We've got a lot going on. We've had Trump's flop of a campaign rally over the weekend. We had voting in Kentucky, in New York, and other places yesterday. Lots of primary races, and a lot of those are unsettled still. We have absentee ballots being a big factor in these races, and we might not know until kind of as late as next week who some of the winners are. But before that, let's take care of just a little bit of business and get to the show. If you're roughing it in the wilderness or traveling to some remote destination, which is probably a good idea in these pandemic times, finding the perfect cup of iced coffee can be a serious challenge. But Grady's Cold Brew is here to help. Grady's reusable all-in-one cold brew kit is ultra-light and packs flat, so it's easy to stash in your suitcase or backpack. All you need to do is add water, tap or bottled or filtered, directly from a mountain stream even. No electricity or refrigeration required when you brew it this fresh. Each kit makes 36 cups of coffee for only $30, and shipping is free. Grady's Cold Brew is independently owned and operated in New York City. It's been there since 2011. So are you ready to give it a swirl? Get 20% off your first order of Grady's Cold Brew at gradyscoldbrew.com with the promo code TPM. Now, a lot of us at TPM just got a sort of home office supply of Grady's Cold Brew, which is very exciting. I'm drinking some now. Kate, you got yours as well?
Yeah, got it. Haven't put the pieces together yet, but it is taking up square footage.
And joining us today is Josh Kavensky, an investigative reporter in our New York office. Hey, Josh.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. How about you? You've got some Grady's on deck somewhere?
Deep in the bowels of my fridge right now. Unfortunately, not with me. I didn't foresee that.
I understand. Well, before we get to some of the electoral news of the moment, Josh, you had a big scoop on the site yesterday that I wanted to talk to you about. Basically, the gist of the story is that the federal government is ending funding for kind of local testing sites in a number of states, right? And Texas is one of those. And some of these places where the coronavirus is really ramping up, you know, in New York, where a lot of us are based here, and in D.C., the numbers have improved a lot. New York City just entered phase two of its reopening. I think Josh and I've just had our first restaurant experiences in the last sort of few months, which is interesting and kind of exciting. But in places like Arizona, places like Texas, Florida, you know, the numbers are just skyrocketing. I think Florida maybe just set a record for kind of highest, you know, COVID cases spike. Josh, you've written a lot about Arizona setting records for ventilator usage, ICU beds being occupied, numbers of cases and all that. So tell us about your story, kind of how it came together and what our listeners should know about the situation right now.
Sure. So the story came from a tip. And I guess I can't really disclose like more about who that was or how that came to be. But basically, we got a sense that the federal government's support for certain testing programs was slated to end at the end of the month. And so we started to look into it. I think it's worth keeping in mind this came in an atmosphere in which President Trump has been, you know, expressing his opposition to testing. In which, you know, public health experts have said that even at the levels the U.S. is testing now, it's not really enough to fully track and contain the outbreaks as they occur. So we were interested to look more into what was going on. And what we found was that basically the federal government, at the very beginning of the pandemic in March, set up number 41 drive-through testing sites around the country. Staffed by both state, local, and also federal employees, and sites where the federal government would provide testing kits and also provide contracts with laboratories and patient notification call center, basically, you know, for areas that don't have capacity to do testing to monitor the outbreak, the federal government can step in and do this. The Trump administration portrays it as something that was always meant to be short term, something that was meant to transition. But what we found was that in a state like Texas, which still has 7 of these sites, the state is still substantially relying on these sites to, you know, meet the testing capacity that it needs to try and track the extent of the outbreak and make sure that people who are sick know what they have. And what we found was that the federal government, in spite of that, the Trump administration, you know, through the Department of Health and Human Services, is letting support, which again is in the form of money, but also these contracts and the testing kits, lapse for the remaining sites. There's still 13 of them around the country, letting it lapse at the end of this month.
And it's interesting, Texas, I mean, one of the first states to really aggressively reopen. I guess it wasn't quite as, I don't know, egregious as Georgia, took a bit more of a cautious approach, but really was pretty early on that. And I think even last night, Governor Greg Abbott had told Texas residents to like stay inside, right? Because the cases have gotten so bad. So tell us kind of about some of the reaction to this story sort of overnight and into this morning, what sort of officials both in places like Texas and then also national, congressional Democrats are saying about it.
Sure. So the reaction I think was, I think when people first saw it, the first thing they thought of was Trump's comments that he's going to shut down testing.
Right.
I mean, that was the context in which people read it. And so the response was that, oh, this is what's happening. Whereas, which is a little bit different, what we reported is that they're not actively making the decision to shut it down. They're letting the funding lapse. I think some people would argue that's kind of a distinction without a difference. I'll leave that to listeners and readers to decide for themselves. More broadly, though, the reaction has been, you know, from national politicians, I think on both, to the extent of both sides of the aisle, that the feds should continue supporting the testing sites, at least those in Texas. We saw Ted Cruz say he had asked HHS and FEMA to continue supporting the sites. 4 Congress people, all of them, I think, are Democrats, representing Houston and the area around it, sent a letter to HHS demanding that the sites stay open or that support continue for the sites. The Assistant Secretary of Health, who's overseeing this, Brett Giroir, he released a statement last night calling our story truthful but misleading, which was nice.
That's like glowing from this administration.
which it was funny, I would argue that his statement was misleading because what he said was that, these sites are antiquated, that they're transitioning to something better, that, you know, the governors of the 5 states still have these testing sites, all agreed with this plan. So far, the governor of New Jersey has said publicly that he agreed with the plan, but we also have this outpouring from local officials, both in Texas and Colorado, and now most recently in Pennsylvania, based on reporting I'm doing, saying that, no, they want these things to remain open.
Right. And is the New Jersey example just maybe, because a state like New Jersey, which is close to New York and Connecticut, those the governors of those states have all worked pretty closely together to get the pandemic under control. Is that just part of the New Jersey in general having it more under control that they support maybe kind of withdrawing this funding or letting it lapse as opposed to these other states that are really still having cases pile up?
It could be. I mean, we're doing more reporting on that right now. The situation there is they have 2 sites that are being funded under this program, both in northern New Jersey and the New York City suburbs. And what they've said is that Murphy's statement was very weird in a way, because what he said yesterday was that, great news, we got the federal government to agree to maintain not those 2 sites, but a separate program that it's running, which allows testing in pharmacies to occur. Mm-hmm. So what's not clear to me is whether or not the loss of test kits and staff at these 2 sites in the New York City suburbs is going to mean an overall loss of capacity for New Jersey, or if they're finding a way out. What other places are doing, like in Dallas, for example, they're going to have to shut down 1 site, which is a big deal because people are facing really long lines to get tested there. But at the same time, they're trying to make up for the lost capacity by dipping into funding they got from the federal government under the CARES Act. I think the distinction for listeners there is that the money that they're getting from the feds to just run these sites doesn't come out of the city budget or the state budget, whereas the CARES Act money that they'd be spending on that could be spent on even more testing or other things. So it just kind of dips into the overall, it takes a chunk out of the overall pie of money that they have.
Sure, that makes sense. Well, maybe let's backtrack for just a second to kind of explain some of the context around Trump's remarks about testing. So this first came out on Saturday night, his big rally in Tulsa. One of the kind of big headlines out of that, other than the sea of empty seats he faced when he got on stage was the president saying he asked his administration to slow down the testing, please.
Right.
That, you know, doing too much testing means you have too many cases, and kind of launched into this whole confusing back and forth that often happens in this administration, where some of Trump's aides and surrogates went on the Sunday morning news shows the next day to say, oh, he was just kidding, and just kind of that was made in jest. Trump himself on Monday came out and said, I don't kid. I wasn't kidding about that. And then his press secretary a little bit later on Monday said Trump was using sarcasm to make a serious point. So that's just sort of the... Anything I'm missing there, Kate, about the kind of surreal, I don't know, 72 hours or so that happened after that? But that's kind of the, that's the background in which this kind of comes out.
Right. No, that seems to cover it to me.
So, Josh, you mentioned you're doing a lot of reporting, obviously, on how this is playing out in these different states and these different, you know, testing sites. Where do you see this going next? What's the kind of, what are the elements of the story our listeners should keep an eye out for as we go forward?
So I think there's two things to pay attention to. One is the ongoing reaction and whether or not that's going to lead the government to reverse itself and keep the sites supported. You know, we're seeing a lot of pressure for that in Texas. There might be some coming in Pennsylvania as well. So that's something to definitely keep an eye on, whether or not they reverse. We also know that the Trump administration tried to do this back in April, and after a public outcry, they were forced to reverse themselves. So that's going to be really interesting to watch. I think the other thing to keep an eye on is that, you know, we're talking about 13 sites that are slated to lose support next week, but there were initially 41. So there's a big question about what happened to the 28 sites in between. I mean, why did they shut down? Did the states do it after asking for them to be opened? We know that the Texas sites have been asking for weeks now for them to be kept open or to be kept supported, and the Trump administration has refused to extend the support. So, you know, what happened with these other sites? Were there requests for extensions that were refused or ignored? And that's, I think, a really interesting question, particularly given that we're seeing all these new hotspots. I think any epidemiologist will tell you that what you need to do to control and monitor and contain an outbreak is really extensive surveillance in the form of testing. I was talking to an epidemiologist yesterday who worked on AIDS outbreaks in Africa, and he was telling me that the first thing they did was they would do widespread testing to just determine how much virus there was, to determine the scope of the outbreak. So the idea that they reduced any kind of capacity over this time, you know, and then we have more cases, is, I think, troubling.
Yeah. Well, Josh, it's great reporting, and it was really awesome to see your story kind of ricochet around the web yesterday, just from obviously public officials who are responding to it, but also just readers and I know other journalists. It's always great to see work like that reverberate. So congratulations on that.
Great. Thanks. It's great talking to you guys.
Good to talk to you.
Thanks,
too.
Josh.
We'll talk soon. Thanks.
Bye.
All right, Kate. Well, let's talk politics now and election nights, which I know is one of your favorite favorite times of the year whenever they come around. So we had a number of pretty consequential primary races last night, a couple of which happened in the New York City region, involving, you know, powerful House committee chairs, Representative Elliot Engel and Carolyn Maloney. You had written about their races this morning, and we still don't know the, you know, the official outcome, but a pretty surprising result in the Engel race, at least. So tell us kind of about, tell us about some of those results.
Yeah, so, I mean, at this point in New York, they can't start tabulating the absentee ballots for 8 days after the election. So, and especially, you know, a race in the time of coronavirus, there are way more absentee ballots than usual. So this race is, you know, unfinished. But Engel in particular is well back right now from his challenger. So, yeah, Engel is kind of absent from the district, or at least that's what he was criticized for being. And it was one of these guys who had won so many times that it was just kind of, you know, the re-election is rote at this point in the House. You're up every 2 years, and just, I guess, his constituents didn't really see him putting his heart into it. And then he had a challenger who was well-suited to the district. And when you have those combination of factors, you know, we've seen it topple veteran lawmakers before. And Engel is kind of in a similar situation. He has received a lot of criticism for being absent from the district, especially during the coronavirus pandemic, because his district includes New Rochelle in New York, which was, you know, the original outbreak in the state. So he was kind of holed up in Washington during that time. and never really had a good explanation for it. I mean, he's old. He's 73, I think, but he never really used that. He was just kind of being evasive, saying like, I've been there. I've been part of it, even though he was in Washington.
Didn't even say he was like, he was quarantining in both places,
in both
which
places,
is literally,
yeah.
You know, that's
exactly.
an oxymoron.
But. Yeah. And to one question about a mask giveaway that was happening in his district, he was like, oh, I was a part of that. And the reporter was like, no, you weren't there. And he was like, well, I was a part of it, you know? So he was already kind of seen as being away from his constituents in, you know, the time of extremely great suffering. And then to add insult to injury during a press conference amid all the George Floyd protests, he was caught on the mic telling the borough president, you know, he wanted to speak, and the borough president was like, well, we have a lot of speakers here. And Engel said something to the effect of, you know, normally I wouldn't care, but I'm in a primary. And honestly, I do buy his explanation here that he wasn't saying he doesn't care about the civil unrest. He was saying normally he wouldn't care about being given the prominence of giving a speech, except that constituents should hear from him on a primary year. But you can see how it's easily misconstrued. And that is how his challenger played it as, you know, we should care about the community always. So.
Right. It comes off kind of craven as sort of like, I'm
exactly.
only here because I'm in a tough primary race.
Right. So kind of combination of those factors. And then his opponent, Jamal Bowen.
That sounds right. Yeah.
Bowen.
He's a high school principal, right?
Middle school.
Yeah,
he also kind of came into his own during the George Floyd protests and swept a lot of late breaking endorsements from the AOC Bernie wing of the party. So Engel looks to be in a pretty dire position, and he's not no one in the party. He heads up the Foreign Affairs Committee, which most recently has been heavily involved in the slate of firings of inspectors general
right.
in the government. So that would be a pretty major coup. And then Maloney she's a bit safer. She has a very, very slim lead right now, only about 1 point. But I think the kind of general consensus is that absentee ballots will probably break her way.
Yeah.
But she's another kind of veteran lawmaker, actually went up against the same challenger in 2018 and, you know, disposed of him with like 20% of the vote. Her race has been different, though. It's been very, very vicious, I guess. He did this gimmick where he made fake Tinder profiles to engage voters. And apparently he also had this joke he made at one point about a 40-year-old and a 17-year-old dating is not that bad. So she packaged those things together to try to make him look creepy, hostile to women. And he said that that was racist and has been really hitting her on her, you know, once championed belief that vaccines are linked to autism. And so he's using that to kind of paint her as like, is this the kind of person you want to lead you during a pandemic? So
Right. Their
race has been different, but still, you know, really close. And in both of those, we're going to have to wait a week to find out either way.
It will be really interesting to see how the absentee ballot results shake out in not just these races, but kind of all over the country where absentee voting and early voting is becoming more of a reality amid the coronavirus pandemic. I mean, just personally, I sent my absentee ballot in on Monday. And so, you know, it maybe hasn't even reached the Brooklyn, you know, elections office where it's ultimately being
RTAs.
Sent to. And so, you know what I mean? It could be, you know, could be in the coming days it's received and then, tabulated into next week, like we're saying.
Right.
And so definitely will be. Yeah, go ahead.
No, I mean, that's a weird thing, too. What you're saying is, like, we as Americans have generally, you know, it's unusual if you don't find out who won the election that night. And
Right. Before
that's only been true because it's really, really close. And like it triggers a recount and things like that. And, you know, it's weird. This is the first time where we could have races that really aren't all that close that we had to wait days to find out who won.
Right. Yeah. Like you said, Engel is trailing by something like 30 points
moment.
Mm-hmm. I guess there's something like a million absentee ballots maybe kind of still in the working their way through the mail system.
Mm-hmm.
But it's pretty remarkable that even in what appears to be a landslide type victory, We still have no official result and won't for a little while.
And that's something that I think, you know, election types have been warning about for a while, and that I don't think, I mean, right now it's like majority of people, unfortunately, don't really pay attention when it's not presidential, you know? So you're not seeing people like taking to the streets being like, did Elliot Engel win or not? But, you know, yeah. In November, we'll have one of the biggest ticket presidential elections of our lifetimes. Yeah. And if these races are any, you know, any sign, if the pandemic is still horrible then and a ton of people are voting by mail, I mean, can you imagine having to wait a week to find out if Trump won or not and how he's going to act? Like, I mean, there's no way he'll be reasonable about it or, you know, trust the process. He's going to be like, this is corrupt.
Totally. I mean, election nights already were basically 4 a.m. situation, you know, in the office until the very wee hours of the morning. And now we're looking at like election week, maybe, and who even knows what that's going to look like.
I mean, I think the only way we will know election night is if it's a landslide.
Yeah. Right.
You know, which, I mean, it could be. We were kind of talking earlier in the show about a New York Times poll out today that showed Biden ahead by double digits, which is pretty.
Yeah, let's talk about sort of the presidential race a little bit, too, and rewind back to Trump's rally over the weekend that we've touched on a little bit at the top of the show. I think leading up to this rally, first of all, it was originally scheduled for Juneteenth, which is the anniversary of sort of the last, I guess, slaves in Texas being, you know, freed or hearing the news of the Emancipation Proclamation. A very significant date, obviously, you know, in the Black community and just in America's history. And Trump decided that that would be a good time to hold a kind of his comeback reelection rally in Tulsa, Oklahoma, which is also the site of the Tulsa race massacre that I think a lot of, you know, it's obviously a key historical event, too, but really became in a way more kind of in the public consciousness after that show The Watchmen.
Oh yeah.
Touched on it in the first episode there. Great show if you haven't seen it. So I think originally, you know, a lot of the worry of this campaign rally was first just the coronavirus threat, obviously, of having tens of thousands of people inside a packed arena, you know, shouting and cheering and exposing one another. And then also, you know, the risk of protesters clashing with Trump supporters outside, any kind of unrest or escalation that might cause. But really, when all the dust settled, I think the big story out of it was how few people actually did show up, right? It was something like 6,200 people, less than half of the capacity of the Bank of Oklahoma Center in Tulsa, where it was held. You know, lots of photos of, I think even the Washington Post called it like a blue wave of empty seats because the arena kind of chairs were all blue seats. To you, Kate, is this kind of a harbinger of how things will go in November? Do you think it's indicative of Trump, you know, losing steam among his supporters? Or is it just that, you know, the coronavirus pandemic is still very much top of people's minds, especially in places in the Southwest, kind of like Oklahoma, where the numbers are increasing and people just aren't comfortable yet being in close quarters. What do you make of all that?
Well, one thing that really struck me was I think it at the very least shows that there is a limit to how far Trump's followers will follow him. You know, like this is a case where Trump has been saying and angling for weeks that you're a weenie if you wear a mask, you know, that we need you to be a warrior and reopen the economy. And that's been his attitude for at least a month at this point. You know, and we've seen some proof that people are following his lead, that especially in red states, there's been a lot of pushback to any kind of mask mandates, you know, creating its own pool of risk. But this is, you know, one of the first very clear-cut examples we saw that at least some of his supporters will not do that, are not trusting his word over their own concern for their health. And while that, for like a normal politician, I think would seem, well, yeah, duh, no one's going to listen to a politician above their own, you know, self-preservation. Trump's fan base is just so, you know, rabid and so...
Yeah, I mean, we saw people lining up almost a week ahead of time, right? I think there were people camping out in line days, right, if not a full week before the rally was set to be held.
And that's kind of the, also the thing that he hung his hat on last time, or like these massive rallies and, you know, just really diehard supporters. And yeah, Tulsa showed us that for a good chunk, you know, their concern for their own health outweighs their support for him, which also shows that they at least are taking what he's saying with pre-heaping spoonful of salt. So right. Now, I mean, I don't know if that transitions into not supporting him anymore, but at least I think it shows cracks in the MAGA monolith that we haven't really seen before.
Right, because Oklahoma is not exactly a swing state, right? Right. I mean, Trump carried it handily in 2016. It's not a swing state. It's not a state that Biden has in play, unlike maybe in Arizona or even Texas or Georgia, some of these states that are traditionally conservative but have started to trend a bit more purple in recent cycles. But yeah, even still, I guess, you know, there was supposed to be an outdoor rally, kind of an overflow event around the Tulsa rally that was canceled, I guess, basically because there was no overflow, right? I mean, there weren't even... The arena itself wasn't even full.
Right. And there's, you know, there are other factors of that rally that are interesting to me. Like, there was a Washington Post reporter there who was kind of taking pictures of, you know, the tailgatey atmosphere outside before people got in. And one observation he had, which is just a trend that I've kind of been observing for the entire cycle, is that there wasn't a lot of specifically anti-Biden merch. You know, there was stuff about the Clintons and liberals being losers in general, but not a lot of specifically targeted anti-Biden things. And I think that is a problem that we've been seeing Trump have this entire time. And that, you know, you, me, and Josh, we discussed months ago, is that Biden is a harder person for Trump to villainize because he... You know, misogyny plays into this for sure, as does just their like different political trajectories. But he doesn't have the decades of suspicion and dislike piled up on him that Hillary Clinton had, which I think, you know, I think Trump is sometimes given credit for this like incredible political prowess, when in reality he tapped into a lingering dislike that's been pretty obvious surrounding Hillary Clinton for, you know, the decade she's been in office.
That's a good point, too, that even at these 2020 rallies, like, they're still chanting, lock her up, right?
Oh, and exactly.
You see the disparaging Clinton merch and all that kind of stuff, and that still, like, fires people up and motivates them. And I guess, you know, it's maybe basking or reveling in Trump's unlikely victory, and, you know, people who support him obviously are somewhat anti-establishment or just kind of want to rub it in liberals' faces. But, but yeah, it's going to be hard to make that stick with Biden, who's kind of the same age as Trump. Not that they're similar in their demeanor or anything like that, but yeah, it's just harder to make that land. It's sort of like, you know, Trump, we've seen reporting that Trump wants to increase the number of debates, and they've roped in Rudy Giuliani, and this is Rudy's next kind of crusade after the Ukraine misinformation, in order to try to get a fourth debate against Biden and what do they call him, basement Biden and all that, you know, all that kind of stuff. But it's just harder to make all of that, those criticisms stick when there's just not that, it just doesn't really resonate with people, you know, sort of, I guess, normal people who aren't on Twitter all day, maybe.
Right. No, I think that's true. And I think Biden, I mean, for better or worse, almost everyone finds him likable, even people who don't like him, you know, who think maybe he's too old or too scattered or too boring. He's just not the figure that kind of evinces this visceral hatred. And he's not a woman, so he doesn't have to deal with that piece of it. Right. And I think, you know, we've kind of seen the Trump campaign's attempts to define him. Like, they kind of went with the creepy route for a while, and Don Jr. was calling him a pedophile and ridiculous things like that. But you know, they're trying to play off of the Joe Biden's too touchy thing. But, you know, I think we haven't seen that stick for a number of reasons. Not least of that is that we already kind of had a nationwide reckoning with Joe Biden's touchiness. And that was a political, you know, kind of, I don't know, a political storm that he was able to survive. And that he had enough people saying he's not you know, he's not sexually gross. He's just paternalistic. He needs to get with the times and realize he can't just touch women, you know, but there was never really a point put on it that was like, he's, you know, that he's invasive in a way that's malicious and not just kind of like, okay, Joe, come on, get it together.
Right. Old Uncle Joe kind of thing.
Right. You know? Not to mention, you know, Trump has had what, 20 women accuse him of sexual assault. So, you know, you have that. And then they've tried to do this kind of basement. He's hiding. He won't come out. But, you know, as we've seen from the Tulsa rally, so won't most people. So it's not like it's really a, I know they're really trying to push this, like, you're a sheeple if you care about your health kind of thing. But
right.
I think vast majority of Americans, even the Trumpster types, are kind of hewing to that line more than to the president's line on this.
Right. So, yeah, speaking of the Trump campaign, like you said, we had a New York Times poll come out Wednesday morning showing Biden leading Trump by, I think, 14 points nationally. Mm-hmm. A week or two ago, we had a CNN poll showing pretty similar results. And that led, I think we touched on this last week or the week before, that led to this whole revitalization of the unskew the polls movement,
right.
where
mm-hmm.
some Republicans want to argue that there aren't enough Republican respondents in these polls, and therefore it's kind of weighted too heavily towards Democrats, or it doesn't capture the full amazing Republican enthusiasm kind of thing. And so I guess there's been other reports that, like, Brad Parscale, the Trump campaign manager, is on the outs. There's all these polls. I mean, do you think, is that inevitable that Trump is going to have to shake up his campaign team or make some staffing changes, or are heads going to roll?
I mean, they probably will, because he's so vindictive and has never really shown a propensity for taking any self-ownership of anything that goes wrong. But, like, every single time we've seen the pivot narrative, the now is the time for Trump to, I don't know, grow up or be a president or forget his political grievance. I mean, we've had almost 4 years of it at this point, and he has never shown an interest or an aptitude in doing that. Like, the most we've seen is him giving one kind of monotoned speech where he sticks to the teleprompter and everyone's like, wow, great, presidential. And then he's back to tweeting, you know, in the car ride home. So, I mean, I think, sure, Trump can get rid of Brad Parscale. He can bring in Lewandowski. He can do whatever he wants. But his brand is, this is who I am. I'm unapologetic. I don't play by your political rules. And I honestly don't think he has the capacity to change that, no matter who he puts around him. And
right.
I think to some degree, last time he hit, you know, it was a lightning strike of a moment where a lot of people had a lot of grievance and a lot of animus and to some degree backlash against Obama's presidency, and he happened to be well positioned against a candidate that was already disliked for a whole host of reasons. And there are now, we're in the midst of a pandemic which he's almost universally considered to have bungled, you know, the economy is in the toilet, and he's running against someone who may be bland, maybe too centrist, but likable in a way that is a complete foil to Trump, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, even the Make America Great Again slogan just rings so much more hollow when the president has been in office for four
right.
years. It's sort of like Make America Great Again, as if it's a sort of future tense statement,
mm-hmm.
you know? It's hard for that to be your whole political brand when you are the one in power.
Right.
And, you know, you've had a Republican Senate the whole time, a Republican House for two of the years of your presidency. And sort of like, why isn't it great already? And now, you know, we've seen Trump try to pivot to transition to greatness, all these, or keep America great, all these things. But obviously, you know, the MAGA is that's the bread and butter.
Right.
And it's hard to move on from that and make a case that, like, we still need to make America great again when you have been in that position to
mm-hmm.
do so, I guess, for, yeah, 4 years
right.
or so.
I mean, and that's something that I just think, I know the Trump people are pushing for more debates, and that, you know, that's the oldest nugget of political wisdom, that whoever's asking for more debates is losing. But, and I know they're doing it because they think, I mean, Biden is a self-admitted gaffe machine, you know, he says dumb things all the time, but I think, you know, you put them in a debate, he's going to get the questions that an incumbent would get. You know, to some degree, it is easier to be a challenger than an incumbent because you don't have to answer to your record. But for Trump, I mean, you're completely right. His whole brand is being an insurgent, an outsider, not in the swamp. And now he's going to have to answer questions like, you know, whenever he says anything about draining the swamp or this or that, you know, the moderators are just going to be like, okay, so why haven't you done it, you know? Or when he blames any of the slew of people that he's hired and fired for being XYZ, you know, the natural question is, well, why'd you hire them? Why didn't you fire them sooner? I mean, I agree with you. I think his brand of hatred of the establishment and the kind of burn it all down mentality that Steve Bannon brought to his original campaign doesn't work so well when he's had 4 years. And, you know, this isn't completely his fault, but he is going out on a note of plague and economic devastation. I mean, that's not a place that any incumbent wants to be.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was pretty genuinely surprising to see the jobs report last month showing an increase in jobs. Obviously, the pandemic plays a big role in that, as, you know, more places open up and restaurants and all these, and hospitality and I guess even health, you know, healthcare offices, dentists' offices, and other places kind of get back up and running. But even Trump's, I guess, now outgoing economic advisor, Kevin Hassert, was saying as recently as like a month ago that unemployment could be in the double digits by November. And that's just that's a very tough position to be in.
Right.
And when people are not working and struggling to make ends meet, there's not much kind of MAGA, I don't know, chutzpah that you can really, I don't know, convince him otherwise that things are great or he, you know, deserves another shot. So lots can happen between now and November, but that's sort of where we stand for now.
I mean, lots can happen. And I think that every single, you know, PTSD-infused Democrat from 2016 is like, oh, there's 5 months for, you know, everything to go wrong for James Comey to send his letter.
Right.
But I think part of that we're seeing right now is there are 5 months where we don't have any assurance that things aren't going to get worse than they are now.
True.
Because, like, we had...
We're back to kind of like March pandemic level new cases every day, you know, and here we are, it's almost July, which is just pretty depressing.
Well, and that's the really, I think, infuriating thing as like a, you know, a lay person, not even as a journalist, you feel like we made this collective social sacrifice to essentially, you know, live under house arrest for 3 months. And the implicit understanding there is we are all going home so you, the government, can set things up so that when we go back into the world, it's safer than it was in March. You know, whether that be widespread testing, which, as Josh has told us, the federal government is allowing to lapse, or, you know, working on, if not a vaccine, then treatments, you know, that kind of thing, so that when we come out of the world in June, it's different. And for the most part, it's not that different. So now we just have people going back out into the world and predictably huge spikes again, and people getting kind of laid back about mask wearing, accompanying spike there.
And also just like alarming numbers of young people getting sick, right?
Right.
I mean, in some of these states that are opening up with, you know, bars and kind of, I don't know, gyms and all these kind of other close quarters types of things. Stay safe out there, for sure.
And I mean, I know you can't blame Trump for all of it, but at some level, the federal messaging has been, just the messaging bit, has been horrible.
Right.
I mean, at the beginning of the pandemic, he said, if you're a young person, don't worry about it, you know?
Right. Yeah. And, you know, we had a couple months of daily coronavirus task force briefings as all over the place and kind of a mess. Those were, we at least heard from public health experts pretty much every day about sort of what the latest was, what the guidance was. And now, even yesterday, you had Anthony Fauci and the director of the CDC and other health experts say they haven't spoken to Trump in, you know, a couple weeks. And, you know, we're hearing less and less from those people about just sort of how to live your life and how to protect yourself and how to stay safe. And instead we have Trump tweeting all sorts of crazy things day in and day out.
I mean, and the sum total of that is that he doesn't want to deal with it anymore. He doesn't want it to be the reality anymore, which, sure, but I mean, it's not going to go away. And it's, I don't know. I think his attempt to pivot to his reelection, I mean, is going poorly, as you can see from Tulsa, and I'm not sure how he would expect things to look different in the future, because those big rallies are just not, they're not going to be a feature of this election cycle, and I'm not sure what else he, I don't even know what else he made his name on last time around, right. But it was not his debate performances. Yeah. So I would not expect those to salvage him.
Yeah. I feel like the best Trump could do, you know, if we're kind of looking at it objectively, is just move them outside. Right. I think it seems like all of the evidence we have is that you're much safer from mm-hmm. the coronavirus if you're outside. That's why restaurants have opened up patios and people are, jamming into the parks and all right. that kind of stuff. And, you know, it's the summer. It seems like maybe that would make sense. Just have these outdoor events and maybe he can get back to some of those pre-pandemic level crowds.
Yeah. You're so right. But I even saw a detail in some article about his rally recently where he doesn't like outdoor as much because it doesn't feel as like raucous, as energized. Mm-hmm. Right. And I mean, which is obviously dumb. And you would think that like he would have his best interests at heart here. But I mean, you'd also think that part of his best interest was to ensure that America has the best testing infrastructure of any country. The only seeming way to me to, operate any kind of a society while there's a pandemic. And he, you know, as Josh showed us, is doing exactly the opposite. Right. So,
right. Yeah. All right. Well, that seems like a good place to leave it. Yep. Josh Marshall, we miss you. We'll see you next week. And, as a reminder, the Josh Marshall podcast is sponsored by Grady's Cold Brew. I'm drinking it now. The staff runs on it. It's the best coffee out there. Accept no substitutes. You can get your first order at 20% off at gradyscoldbrew.com using the promo code TPM. You can also order it off of Amazon if that's your thing, or check it out at your local grocery store, local specialty shop, all that kind of stuff. Support those local businesses still. Even as the restaurants are opening up, it's tough times for a lot of those places for a while. So do what you can to support. And Kate, thanks very much. Talk to you next week.
See you next week. Bye.